Sick of me. Over to you, Paul.
Well, just before Mr. Maturity, there's one matter I wanted to clarify. It was in response to your question this morning, Dr. Giles, about where you might find the updates and having some direction. I don't know if you'll have seen this, but one of the memoranda that was filed by TTR with the panel convener has within it a summary of all of the places within the IA, the impact assessment, that have the references within it. And so that's the 4 August memorandum. Hopefully that gives you exactly what you're after, but if you need more direction than that, please come back to us as well.
Thank you.
All right, Mr.
Maturity. Tēnā kuia te hiamana, kautau ngā memo te tēku, tēnā tātata, tēnā kautau katoa. If you'll leave, sir, I'll sit here if that's okay.
Yes, of course.
So, as you may have seen in the PowerPoint, there's a series of bullet points that I'm going to speak to. Recognising that this is the opportunity for a presentation and not the merits here in itself, there are a number of crisp points that I can make in addressing the framework. But just at the outset to indicate, as some of the members know, of the various hats that I wear, I've practiced in the environmental area for a few years and addressed some of the matters that are relevant to my address in so far as treaty jurisprudence, tikanga Māori is concerned.
No, that's just the recording.
And apologies if that was lost on the audio. So starting with the Supreme Court decision, as the panel are probably aware, in terms of the EEZ Act, Z Act, too much American TV, the Supreme Court addressed two key matters in this context, one in relation to treaty principles and also to tikanga, and just by way of reference, which the panel probably already has, in the summary of the decision, the Supreme Court decision, paragraphs 8 and 9 address those matters, both principles and tikanga. That was relevant because, again, as you're aware, the EEZ Act had section 12, the treaty principles, and in relation to tikanga on the merits, that arose from section 59 with the reference to existing interests and other applicable law. To round out this point in terms of context, the memorandum from TTR of 4 August made the point, which is also reflected in the minutes of the panel, insofar as the legal framework that was before the Supreme Court is very different to that before this panel in terms of the Fast Track Act. And as an example, paragraph 7 of the 4 August memorandum addressed that particular point, which I'll walk through in terms of the balance of the bullet points. So as I've foreshadowed and the panel's aware, the FTA Act does not have a treaty principles clause. Rather, section 7 addresses the relevant considerations insofar as obligations under existing treaty settlements and customary rights that are recognised under the MAC legislation, etc. Again, acknowledging that this is not the merits hearing, but as an important point of context, TTR says that none of those considerations apply here insofar as any existing settlements or recognised MAC, etc. interests overlap with the application area. And so as a consequence, sections 82 and 84 would not apply. It may be of help to give the panel a couple of references in terms of some of the recent decision-making under the Fast Track Act. There are two. The first is a judgment of Justice Gendall on application for judicial review of the acceptance of a Fast Track application. And the reference is Ngāti Kuku Hapu Trust against the Environmental Protection Agency. The reference is 2025 NZHC 2046. I'll come to that in the following bullet points. And another example is the Ports of Auckland panel decision in relation to Bledisloe Wharf, etc. where they've addressed matters are relevant to Section 7 of the FTA Act. I can talk to those further if the panel wishes when we come back for any questions you have. So in terms of the treaty principles consideration and as addressed in that decision of the High Court that I've referred to, of Justice Gendall, paragraph 46 of the court's decision in addressing the likelihood of success of the arguments before the court on JR, and this is starting the second sentence of paragraph 46, the court says, the principles of Te Tiriti o Waitangi are not referred to in the FTAA, with the Act instead providing that those exercising functions, powers and duties under the Act must act consistently with obligations under existing treaty settlements. So it's repeating what's in the Act, but making that point. And the court makes a similar observation in relation to tikanga. In the very next sentence in that decision, the court says, similarly, tikanga appears only to be referred to in relation to conducting a hearing on a fast-tracked application. So those are two key examples of how there is a very different legislative context before this panel, rather as opposed to what was before the Supreme Court under the EEZ Act. Turning next to consultation, and as you've heard comprehensively in terms of the consultation that's been undertaken, the panel will be aware of Section 11 and the requirements of consultation there. I don't need to go through that given what you've heard. The point for TTR is that it says it's met the requirements of Section 11. And finally, on this framework setting, the final bullet point in terms of the parameters for decision making, Section 85 is quite clear that there are parameters around the reasons for the decision for the panel to make, as opposed to examples like EEZ and RMA. So I wanted to just address that framework. These matters will be live before the panel come the time of the merits considerations as part of the process, and obviously you'll hear from all the parties in terms of their representations on those matters. Sort of to set that framework for any discussion the panel wish to have.
Can I just ask you this question, which is a procedural question, really? What would you suggest is the best way for us to engage with the applicant and commenters on a discrete issue like the legislative differences and the application of tikanga, treaty principles, etc., which is essentially a legal issue? Would you envisage that we might have a hearing on that issue as a discrete issue? Or would you consider it more appropriate for there simply be some issues stated by the panel and then written responses to it? What's your view about that?
As the legislation makes clear, the panel has discretion and jurisdiction to make decisions on the conduct of the process that, as you've touched on. I'm not aware at this stage in terms of other parties as to how they want to approach those considerations process-wise. But appreciate that's not the question you're asking me, but just for context. So there are a variety of ways of addressing that, as you've indicated, Chair. In the context of the legislative regime and the applications that I've seen, through personal involvement, but I've reviewed in so far as to how the panels have approached that, it's all very contextual. This is a very different type of application given the background that Mr. Eggers has taken you through. And so a lot of these matters have been ventilated in terms of substance, but recognising that there's a different legislative regime and the clear intent of Parliament as to how it's wanting these matters to be traversed. Substance and efficiency are clearly relevant insofar as how matters proceed. So what I would say is, insofar as the decision for the panel to make, a process that allows for parties to express the views that the panel wants to hear in an efficient and effective way is the best way to proceed. Now, that's going to be context dependent on when the panel gets to the point of making an assessment of how it wishes to proceed.
Yeah. I mean, I think the guidance prepared by the conveners makes the comment that sometimes a hearing is a much more efficient way of addressing a particular issue rather than exchanging memoranda and minutes and all that sort of thing. So I'm just wondering whether you have a view, and no doubt we'll have to ask other participants about this as well, but I'm interested in your thoughts, on whether or not it might be appropriate to have a discrete hearing, because one of the unusual features of this application, of course, is the fact that there's been so much consideration of the project under different regimes.
Yes.
So how far can we go to take account of what the Supreme Court said or what some other DFC might have said about something, given that we're in Maryland, your environment? So that's the sort of issue that I wonder whether might not be usefully wrestled with by some lawyers in front of us.
Two further things occur to me on that, which is it's helpful your guidance there. And that is, one, there's a cascade of approaches that could be taken by starting on the papers and seeing how the panel feels about that. Related to that is how clear, and this is a question of the panel, is that topic insofar as the two sets of legislation are very, very different. And so if the answer is quite clear in terms of how the panel sees it, that would beg the question, is a hearing really necessary? Yeah. Hence why a cascaded approach could be the way to navigate that.
Yes, yes. I think probably if we were to go to a hearing, we would ask for some written material first to start everybody off. Mm. Yeah, all right, that's helpful. Thank you. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, thank you. And with your lead, sir, I'll depart at a point.
It's been nice to see you, Mr.
You too, sir.
Thank you, Paul. Okay, now, Dr. Alistair McDermott will present to you the ecological and sedimentation effects summary and monitoring plans. Thanks, Alistair.
I've just given it to Alison.
It's here now. Yep. Good afternoon. I just thought I'd introduce myself just a little more. My name's Alison McDiarmid. I'm a regional manager now at the Wellington campus of Earth Sciences New Zealand, which came into effect on the 1st of July, and it's a combination of NIWA and GMS. So two sister CRIs have recently merged to form this new institute, and at some stage over the next 12 months, we'll be welcoming the New Zealand Meteorological Service into our institution. I was awarded a PhD in zoology by the University of Auckland in 1988 and have 38 years of professional experience in marine ecology and fisheries. I think it's important to note I've led NIWA's involvement in TTR's NIWA's involvement in the project since 2010, undertook some of the field work, authored co-authored many of the NIWA reports, and led the review undertaken by the 2016 application to identify what areas of marine science needed updating for the 2025 application. So there's a lot to get through, so I just thought I'd just briefly outline what I'll cover so you know what's coming up. So I'll start with a physical description of the project area called the PPA, proposed project area. and the South Taranaki Bight, often abbreviated on their slides as the STB, to provide the ecological context and setting for the evaluation of effects. And then I'll focus on some core effects. So firstly, I'll cover the shoreline stability, waves and surf. Then get on to the sediment plume, the model itself, and the modelling that took place, with particular reference to underwater light and effects on primary productivity, effects on benthic habitat impacts and recovery, fish and fishing, seabirds and marine mammals. Then briefly talk about underwater noise, particularly in relationship to marine mammals. And I'll briefly touch on the proposed monitoring programs. Okay.
Just a forward?
That down here. If you just use these ones.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay, great. So here's the proposed project area. It's located on this shallow shelf, often called the Partia Shoals, has been outlined previously. It's 22 to 36 kilometres offshore, so well offshore, but still in quite shallow water, so 25 to 40 metres water depth. And as Alan has indicated, this particular PPO is outside the coastal marine area in the EEZ. So the surface sediments in this area are dominated by fine to medium sands. Offshore further, there are some muds. They increase in the offshore areas deeper than 50 metres depth, the water depth, and in some areas close inshore, close to river mouths, where there's a lot of sediment being carried down those rivers and deposited in the near shore and the environment. So the muds on this picture here are indicated by the orange segments of those sediment pie charts. Gravels and coarse sands occur more frequently to the east, south, and west of the proposed project area. So areas falling off this southern flank of the Partia Shoals and further out of its western flank. But over the proposed project area, it's predominantly medium sands and fine sands. Closer to shore, the seabed is dominated by fine sands. This is in quite shallow inshore areas. You can see the proposed project area here, Whanganui here, and you can see in this area it's dominated by sands. And up towards Partia and Hauora, there are, it's an increasing amount of rocky reef in particular areas. Areas is subject to very strong currents. There are twice daily lunar tidal currents, scheduled to account for between 40 and 80% of the measured current strength, and its variability, both within the proposed project area and also the South Taranaki Bight as a whole, in depths of less than 50 metres, so a very strong tidal component to the currents. And the peak ebb and current speeds range between 0.13 and 0.25 metres a second, so reasonably fast. The orientation of the tidal flow is along shore. So northwest, south, southeast sort of directions, which has important implications for the sediment plume dispersion. The current direction and strength is substantially affected by up to 1 metre a second by surface wind. So in periods of strong winds, the current can be forced in that particular direction. And the predominant wind directions are from the west and southeast, the strong winds producing currents in a constant direction for more than 24 hours. So what is shown here is a broader view of the current systems within the STB. And you can see that under calm conditions there is a prevailing current coming off the northwest tip of the South Island, off Farewell Spit, as a result of the influence of the Derval Current, which comes up the west coast. Flows past Farewell Spit and into the South Taranaki Bight, and towards the southeast, towards Cook Strait. During times of moderate to strong west to northwest winds, the prevailing southward drift is considerably enhanced, and it can be altered though in periods of current from the southeast, which for a period can turn the drift towards the northwest. So depending on what is happening in the environment, it's usually this sort of flow, but it can be driven the other way during storm events. So this figure here shows the orbital velocities on the seafloor from waves. So the coastal environment out to water depths of 50 metres is a high energy environment with significant wave heights in excess of 2 metres routinely experienced. So instruments laid out on the seafloor. As part of oceanographic studies for TTR, found wave heights of up to 7.1 metres during storm events. And these waves either generally came from a southeast or southwest direction. And the further into the South Taranaki Bight towards Whanganui and Foxton, the smaller the waves and the calmer the environment generally. So the seafloor sediments on the Paihatia Shoals are subject to both strong current flows and wave orbital velocities. That's the bottom part of the wave where it actually interacts with the seafloor, as actually a circular motion felt on the seafloor. And storm events.
Can I just ask?
Yes, please.
Does that mean that sediments are being picked up from the seabed?
It does. So those wave events can suspend, resuspend sediments from the seafloor and then get carried depending on the current strength and direction at that time.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So storm events can typically generate wave orbital speeds several times the average, as you might expect. So what is shown here are the median or the mean, sorry, the mean orbital velocities. So the average. So a little note about background suspended sediments. As Alan has indicated earlier, the measurements taken around the project area and across the Paihatia Shoals as part of oceanographic studies carried out by NIWA recorded typical maximum concentrations of up to 25 milligrams per litre of suspended fine sediment near the sea surface, with higher peaks inshore after significant rainfall or following significant wave activity. So those peaks are either caused by flood events coming down the rivers and then being carried along the sea, along the shoreline, or during storm events, resuspension of sediments off the seafloor. Offshore, near the 50-metre water depth, near surface suspended fine sediment concentrations were typically less than 10 milligrams a litre, with small peaks occurring during or just after periods of significant rainfall, indicative of river inputs. Inshore, the suspended fine sediment concentrations up to 1,900 milligrams per litre were recorded close to the seabed, mostly associated with high wave activity. So resuspension of sediments already on the seafloor. So this is all background stuff. This is without mining.
Understood.
Further offshore over the proposed mining area and in the adjacent areas, the seabed suspended fine sediment concentrations were typically less than 10 milligrams a litre, but were recorded up to 80. The highest concentrations were not always associated with rainfall events or strong large wave activity, but could also be a result of advection or movement of water masses from one place into the proposed project area from areas upcurrent. So I'm just trying to paint a picture of how dynamic this particular area is. These suspended sediments have an impact on optical water quality, which has consequences for primary productivity, both from phytoplankton in the water column and also algae on the seafloor, both microphytobenthos, which Ellen mentioned earlier, and also seaweeds growing on reef-form structures. So NIWA undertook two boat surveys and collected water samples from 11 nearshore sites across the South Taranaki Bight, and had a six-week deployment of instruments on nearshore moorings in approximately 10 metres of water. That was undertaken to assess temporal variability and establish relationships of the optical properties with the suspended sediment concentrations. Boat surveys show that suspended sediment concentrations and diffuse light attenuation are greatest closest to shore, and visual clarity increases rapidly with depth and distance offshore. So dirty inshore, cleaner further offshore and in deeper water. There's also a reduction in suspended sediment concentrations and a subsequent increase in visual clarity underwater in the south to southeast direction, travelling down past Whanganui, down towards Foxton and the areas further south. Further, both coloured dissolved organic matter, which is a component of seawater, particularly in coastal waters, and chlorophyll A concentrations decreased with increasing water depth and distance offshore. So there's those three different components that make up the optical water quality, both the suspended sediments, but also the dissolved organic matter, the coloured dissolved organic matter and chlorophyll itself from the plants living in the water column. Suspended sediment concentrations also increased as a result of increased river flows and the related sediment load inputs, with high suspended sediment concentrations resulting in reduced visual clarity. And some inshore increases in suspended sediment concentrations occurred during periods of high wind speeds and low river discharges, and typically wave stirring entrains seafloor sediment into the water column and affects water clarity. I think that's a pretty clear effect. So I'll now turn to some of the effects potential effects of the mining operations. So to assess the shoreline processes and coastal stability, extensive field investigations were conducted by NIWA over 2 years, including oceanographic measurements and shoreline monitoring, as outlined in sections 3.2.3 and 3.2.4 of the application document that you've got in front of you. Key findings outlined in these sections are the natural landforms and geomorphic character of the beaches and cliffs is unlikely to change as a result of the project. These areas are subject to large natural background variation. Sand is pulled inshore or offshore depending on the wave conditions experienced on that part of the coastline. Changes in shoreline stability are highly unlikely to change as a result of the project. The grain size of the sediment on the beaches is unlikely to change. The beach sediments primarily come from cliff erosion and river outwash. TTR engaged NIWA to undertake nearshore wave modelling to consider the impacts of the project on wave characteristics, and eCoast Marine Consulting and Research were engaged to investigate the impact of the project on surf breaks in the South Taranaki Bight. Although the deposition of deored sediments will fill the majority of the extracted areas, it results in a mound and pit at either end of the mining tract. And I think Alan attempted to outline, and I think you asked a question about where those things would actually be. So at the start and end of each 900 metre mining track, there'll be a small mound, probably at the western end, I think, Alan, and in a pit at the southeast end.
What happens to those?
So those then eroded over time,
yeah.
And there's a study specifically that looks into that, which documents that, and that's in the list of reports that you've got in front of you.
Okay.
The largest of those pits in particular will last for years before it's completely filled in. But eventually it'll smooth, but it won't completely disappear until a period of years has passed, and that's documented in the paper by McDonald and Goring, I think. In the report, sorry, not the paper. And the assessment also examined whether the existing pits and mines, the resulting pits and mines, have the potential to alter the direction of wave approach and the wave height near shore in the South Taranaki Bight, and therefore alter longshore transport of sediment and patterns of erosion and accretion on the shoreline. So on page 160 of the impact statement, it outlines, it's got this figure here, which shows the difference between the significant wave heights and existing bathymetry over the modelled domain for a scenario where we've got a mound on the western edge of the mining area and a pits on the eastern, southeastern edge. So key findings under the worst case scenario of an 8 to 9 metre mound and a 9 to 10 metre pit were increases in wave height in the order of 100 millimetres only. It's about this change in that height around the Manawapu River. A decrease in the wave height in the order of 100 millimetres around Pātia. An increase in the wave period of less than 0.5 seconds north of Pātia, and a decrease in the wave period of less than 0.1 seconds at Pātia itself. So very minor effects. Residual pits and mounds will occur at the end of the lanes in which the iron sand recovery and deposition occurs. It is likely that pit depths and mound heights will be significantly smaller than the case presented here. So this is a worst case
scenario. So would a worst case scenario be when they're taking out maybe the full 11 metre depth?
Yeah.
But if you're doing a 1 metre or a yes. 5 metre depth, it would be smaller.
That's right. So that it was the worst case that was modelled to determine what the worst case effects on waves inshore would actually be. And the conclusion from this work is that overall the impacts of the project operations on the wave and surf environment within the project area at the coast are considered to be insignificant, given the highly variable background in all those things. I'll now move on to the sedimentation and the sediment plume effects, and start with a quick outline of the regional ocean modelling system model that was developed. And this refers to pages starting at 132 in your and the impact assessment. So the sediment plume model uses the regional ocean modelling system, which is a widely accepted ocean coastal model with optional embedded models of suspended sediment and sediment bed processes included in the model itself. The model has been used to track and display sediments at concentrations that are frequently too small to be seen if they were actually in the water column, but nonetheless the model can actually track these particles to see where they've originated from and where they end up. The model grid resolutions vary between the domains. So shown here is the wide area model domain, and with the nested modelling components inside that wide area one. So mainly refers to the modelling results refer to this domain area here, that oblong box, which reaches from about Kennedy Island up to the Cape. So there was a 2 kilometre grid for the outer domain and 1 kilometre grid for the inner domain, with the option of using a 500 metre resolution for exploration of specific effects at certain places. And the 500 metre resolution is used to investigate the sensitivity of the model results to grid resolution, and that's documented in the report by Hadfield and McDonald 2015. So the model requires the input of a large number of parameters relating to the sediment classes, the grain size and density of those sediments, the porosity of the seabed itself to water, the incoming background sediments from rivers and the seabed itself, sediment input rates into the model area, the settling velocity of sediments in the water column, critical bed shear stresses for the erosion of the sediment from the seafloor by waves and currents, various erosion rate parameters, and then suspended sediments from iron sand recovery operations itself at the suction phase, the vacuum cleaner head, so to speak, and the hydrocycline overflow, which is, I think, still part of the processing on the ship. The discharge from that, and then the discharge of de-oiled sediments off the bow of the ship back into the pits. Also mentioned here that HR Wallingford, which you've heard raised being talked about earlier, in the UK conducted laboratory tests using sediment samples from the South Taranaki Bight to better define how discharged de-oiled sediments behave in the near field, and that's right around the discharge point, particularly looking at the potential for flocculation of those sediments into larger lumps and the settling rates of fine particles, particularly when they are within a very dense stream of particles coming out of the de-oiled sediment discharge. So those two things have very important effects on the behaviour of sediment in the plume. So you've seen these sorts of diagrams earlier, so Alan showed a version of these. So shown here in the figure on the left are the median near surface concentrations of suspended sediment from mining at a particular source at location A. So location A, when you see a reference to it in any further conversations here this afternoon or in the reports, this is mining location A. It's at the very northern end, at the inshore end of the proposed mining area. We'll see also references to mining location B, and that is at the extreme southwest end. And these diagrams, which you see in various parts of various reports, often refer to area A or B. And they give an indication of the extremes of the position of the plume from the most inshore to the most offshore. So extensive modelling indicates, this is in Hadfield and McDonald 2015, that's an area where it's been most extensively discussed, but also in McDonald and Hadfield 2017. So that modelling indicates that background suspended sediment concentrations are higher inshore and decline offshore, just exactly as was found by the sampling, and away from the river sources. The sediment plume that will be created during mining operations will travel predominantly in an east-southeast direction from the source. So just note that this is north here, so this coast has been flipped around, so we can get it all on a page, and that this is a logarithmic scale. So every step here is an increase by from 0.1 to 1 gram, milligram per litre to 10 to 100 to 1,000. The suspended sediment concentration resulting from mining operations will be greatest at the mining site within a kilometre or two, and the magnitude in the plume will reduce rapidly with distance from the mining location while the background values increase as the plume travels towards the coast. Comparison of the background with the background plus the iron sand extraction activities, so that's comparing the background to the background plus the mining, indicates the impact of the plume on the suspended sediment concentrations. And if you compare these, they show a movement offshore, or an apparent movement offshore of the surface 1 milligram per litre threshold of about 6 kilometres outwards over the Paihatia shoals. So if we just focus on the 1 milligram, which is in the purple there, this purple line here, you can see that it just touches that northwest corner of the PPA in the background, and it moves to about a third of the way down in this background plus a mining operation. And what is shown here is the median. So this is for half the time it'll be this large. Half the time it'll be smaller, half the time it'll be larger.
Alison, will we find in the documentation any modelling where the wind current is going the other way on those storm events?
There's an excellent video which was created. I think it was submitted as part of the evidence.
Is that Dr. McDonald's video?
Yes.
I don't think it's in evidence, but we could provide it.
Yeah, and that shows a year long simulation using real climate driven model. And it shows how storm events impact on where that plume goes.
Would you like us to
provide? I think that'd be useful.
Yeah, it's probably the best way of getting a real feel for the how dynamic the area is, because these diagrams give the impression of something quite static.
Yeah. Right. We'll need to adopt a proper process for the admission of that. I might get some advice from Elliot about how we handle that. Would that be a request from the panel for further information? Could you flag that then? And what I think we might do, Natalie, is if you formulate an inquiry on that information. And that means that we'll go on the website and everyone will have an opportunity to see it.
But just thinking about that, it would only be relevant if the swell height's less than 4 metres, wouldn't it? So storm events with a swell height greater than 4 metres, where you won't be operating.
That's true.
That's not relevant.
Yeah, that's true.
So
yeah.
That will be in the model.
Right. So
that is in the model. Over 4 metres is in the model. You won't be operating now.
Okay, so that's irrelevant.
Yeah.
Correct.
But can you have a wind direction going to this southeast where you don't have 4 metres as well?
From the southeast, so blowing up through Cook Strait towards that area without a swell, depending on the angle, the particular angle, it could be becoming sort of more obliquely off the Manawatu, I guess, without a particularly large swell. So that video covers the whole range of wind and rainfall events and all that sort of thing. So it's driven by the actual climate recorded at the time, and the particular climate slice is documented. So you can see, and I think it covers a period. It was a so-called weather bomb event that occurred, a very large storm that occurred in the South Taranaki Bight during that simulated period, so you're able to see that the impact of that as well.
Thank you.
Okay, so the last point I wanted to make on this slide was suspended sediment concentrations from the project will be moderate near to the project area and closer to the coast. The project-derived suspended sediments will be much lower than the background levels and not discernible. So it'll be impossible to see where the plume from the mining operations actually impacts on the coast. It'll be lost in all the background.
Did the model also predict actual sedimentation?
It does. So
it's sort of there's sort of a bit of a mixed reference in all the documents to sedimentation, but I haven't really seen.
Yeah, so in that report by Hadfield and McDonald 2015, there is a whole section on sedimentation, so the deposition of sediment on the seafloor, but it's very, very small. Mm. It's generally less thick than human hair over a large area over a long period. So it's a very minor effect. You probably couldn't even measure it.
That's probably why it's not mentioned.
Yeah. So I haven't mentioned it today because it's a very tiny effect. So it's the suspended sediments which are the more important effect, I think. Despite the low concentrations of suspended sediments, because it's really the fines which get carried any distance, and even though they're in a very low concentration, they do have an effect on the light and environment. And NEWA provided an updated assessment of the optical water quality impacts based on the worst case sediment plume modelling. You can refer to that in pages 145 to 150 in the main document you've got in front of you. And this light effects is generally talked about in terms of what it does to the euphotic zone depth, the depth at which the downwelling iridescence has fallen to about 1% of its surface value. That's often taken, it's a little bit arbitrary, but it's the depth at which, or the light level at which photosynthesis normally ceases. The modelling shows that with mining at site A or B, so the inshore or the offshore mining site, the median euphotic zone depths northeast of the mining site will be considerably shallower than in the background case, with discernible effects at the trips and the Grand Banks. So in this diagram here, the Grand Bank, which is an area of shell hash, is located here on the G, and the traps, which is a reef, is shown here at location T. And there are other rocky reefs inshore of the mining site, but we'll get onto some of them later. But these two locations were indicated during feedback as particularly important. So that's what occurs at the traps and Grand Banks, and in contrast, the mining is predicted to have very small effects on the euphotic zone depth near shore, because it's dominated by the sediment coming down from the rivers and being resuspended near the coastline itself. So the sediment plume will result in absorption and backscattering of light, which will reduce light availability for phytoplankton and benthic plants. but these effects are small. Water column primary production averaged over the sediment modelling domain, so that oblong, basically the area shown here in each of these panels, that's the sediment modelling domain, would reduce by about 1% and 0.8% when extraction is occurring at locations A and B respectively, with the largest reductions focused close to the extraction site itself. But the impacts on primary juices are considered to be negligible because even though light levels may be affected to some extent, the actual primary production is thought to be unaffected because primary producers are resilient to short-term fluctuations in light available through a process called photoadaptation. And the likelihood that primary production by phytoplankton in the South Taranaki Bight is likely nutrient limited, not light limited. So generally, phytoplankton the limit to primary production is probably limited by the availability of nutrients, not the light levels per se. So a small reduction in light probably won't have any effect. Also, many microalgae may also be capable of heterotrophic production, mostly uptake of dissolved organic matter, so they can actually directly absorb other nutrients. The macroalgae growing on reefs also have the additional advantage of being able to store photosynthetic products in their larger bodies for extended periods, so they can withstand some periods of low light. And the presence of the plume and effects on light levels will be increasingly intermittent at sites greater than 2 kilometres from the active point of mining. So in the report by McDonald and Hadfield 2017, there are some nice figures which show for various locations, including the traps and Grand Banks, how the plume, because of the variability in currents and tides and storm events and that sort of thing, how the plume, its effect on light levels and therefore potentially on primary production will be a very intermittent effects at various places. So it won't be a continual period of lowered light. It'll be all raised, increased sediment concentrations in the water column. It'll be a fluctuating effect of hours to a day or two at the most.
Is there any evidence about how long the sediment plume effects will exist after the cessation of mining? So, for example, if there's a storm, mining stops for a period. Excuse me. How long it continues to have an effect before there is no effect at all?
Well, the effect will, it'll, the larger particles will settle out almost immediately.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about the fines, some of those fines will stay in the water column until they're carried out through Cook Strait over a period of days.
Right. So, yes, the currents take over.
Yeah, the currents quite quickly transport them through the area.
Yeah.
And some of them are settling on the seafloor, albeit in a very thin layer, but most of the sediments will actually fall and be contained within the mining pits.
Right.
Okay, I'll turn now to the effects on the benthos on the seafloor ecology. Shown here is a map of the South Taranaki Bight showing the proposed project area and sampling locations, sampling undertaken by NIWA. You'll see there are a great many. Some of the key things to note here are the rocky outcrops, shown in brown. You'll see that they lie inshore or to the east of the proposed mining area. And this is not, this is just where the random sampling occurred. So we now know there are a lot more rocky reefs occurring inshore, closer to the coast, but they're not well mapped. So there is a more recent report undertaken by NIWA with Mark Morrison as a lead author. It is listed in the main report in front of you. Just forget what page that is on, but it'll be in your list. And that identifies a series of more recent discoveries of rocky reefs inshore of the proposed mining area. There may be some other locations which are known to fishermen and divers, but are still to be formally charted. But I understand that TTR will be engaging in some further seabed surveying in the areas immediately around that northern edge of the mining area to make sure that the location of those most vulnerable rocky reefs is actually properly documented and known to everyone.
When will that occur, sorry?
I presume set that in that pre-commencement monitoring.
These are one or two sites that were identified in the hearing process by various groups, and we took that on board. We proposed it in our proposed conditions, and we will survey those sites and include them for monitoring. And we obviously won't go out there and do that now because we don't have any consents, but as soon as we do, that's in that 2-year period before production.
If I can add, that's just in Schedule 2 of the conditions. There's the table which identifies those additional three sites. I think they're identified as sites 8, 9, and 10. I can't remember the exact names off the top of my head, but I can talk to you when it comes to my presentation.
So on this diagram here, you can see that in the proposed project area, the inner half is dominated by sand waves, the yellow sand ripples, and it's still sandy in the remainder, but it tends to be dominated by short-lived high-density polychaete worm community. These are small worms about so long, which live in the top part of the water column, of the seabed, Further offshore, where the shelf starts to slope down towards the deeper seabed beyond 50 metres, there are live and dead dog hockle beds. Demarcated here in the orange with the dot inside. Orange is a lot of the live ones, the rubble, the bivalve rubble, the tusitona. Dead shells are shown with the red dot inside the orange. So these are very large, massive shells, very robust shells which can accumulate on the seafloor, and the shells can last hundreds of years. I think there are some published reports of the ages of some of that shell hash being several thousand years old.
Do those organisms originate in that area, or do the shells just somehow end up there?
No, there are lots of live animals there, and they originate from that area. So they live on the margins of that shelf, where it starts to fall off the top of the plateau down to that steeper edge, slightly steeper edge. And then well offshore, beyond 50 metres, there's an area of bryozoan rubble, probably formerly much larger, but you can see there are trawl tracks still there. You can see that when you've that diagram that Alan showed earlier showing the trawl marks or the trawl tracks, you can still see the on the sea floor where trawls have gone through and broken that bryozoan environment down. So there are live bryozoan there.
So what are bryozoan?
It's a colonial filter feeding animal. Looks a little bit like coral. They're sometimes called coral beds, but they're actually not a coral itself. They're actually something called a bryozoan. So those bryozoan assemblages also dominated by sessile, or by mobile taxa such as crabs and gastropods. So the environment on the top of the shelf in the centre areas is quite a very low diversity sort of environment, whereas down on the deeper margins it becomes a much more rich biodiverse area.
But I think it's important to note, we're not operating out there. That is upstream, if you like, from where we're operating, and any effects will be in the opposite direction.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes.
Okay. So the main direct physical impact on the aquatic community by the mining operations will be the eventual physical removal and death of all sessile and sedentary taxa, as well as the relatively immobile taxa such as starfish and large gastropods or snails within the project area. Very close to wherever the mining operations are currently taking place, the effects of suspended sediments will be extreme at the suction face and within 1 to 2 km of the point where the sediment is returned to the seabed. However, I think it's important to point out that these effects will not occur over the entire project area all at once, but will sequentially and gradually occur within a short distance of the mining ship as it traverses the proposed project area over the course of, sorry, I've said 35 years here, 20 years. I think you've got the point that from my earlier points that the proposed project area and the immediately adjacent areas are very exposed, high energy, highly dynamic, sandy environments and are subject to frequent episodic disturbances from wave events and river inputs during high rainfall events. Consequently, the existing benthic community in the proposed project area is dominated by short-lived, opportunistic and early successional colonisational stages with a very low abundance of longer-lived organisms. And this community is well adapted to disturbance because it occurs on such a frequent basis.
You mean from natural...
From the natural storm events that go through. So every time there's a front that goes through. So once a week there's often a storm event or a high wind event that goes through as a progression of lows passes over the country.
Just before you move on, in that first bullet point you mentioned death of all.
Yeah.
Does that mean that, let's say a starfish is sucked up, is there nothing that will survive the up on the ship along and out the other?
Well, there's a potential for some of those larger things, in particular the large snails and the starfish, to be screened out. There's a coarse screen to prevent those larger things, any rocks, if there are any, shell hash, for instance, from going in through the entrainment process. And those will be discharged over the side. So there's a chance that they may live, but worst case, they'll be dead. I think on a conservative basis, you have to assume that all the fauna and flora actually on the seabed and on the sand will die at some stage. then it comes becomes a question of, well, then how fast will those sorts of populations recover? I think is the important point. And basically what I'm saying here now is that those, that community is now consists of short-lived, fast-growing, opportunistic species. It's because that's the sort of environment it lives in now. So if you suck up everything up, you kill all those polychaete worms and other things living on the seabed, how fast will they recover?
Prep yourself, such a nice segue. That's a good one more question. In terms of the worst case modelling scenario, how was it determined? So worst case in terms of what? Is it largest plume or the direction of the most sensitive habitats?
So this was developed by an expert group in the 2017 hearing. So basically they took the plume model, and because it's got 13 different parameters on it, all with a range, they took the top of the range for each of those things to make it into a worst possible.
Yeah, so that's, I tried to follow that, and I couldn't quite find the core intention. So was the intention then to make the plume as big as possible?
Yes.
So it's not necessarily because, we see the more sensitive habitat more in the different direction. So it's not necessarily a worst case in terms of impacts on sensitive habitats, because it's not necessarily worst case direction. It's literally just the largest plume, but still applied in the
It's the largest feasible plume. No, it's not making it unrealistic. It's within the bounds of what is possible. What are the extreme values, basically?
But it's hypothetically possible that a smaller plume in a different direction could have a more adverse effect. Was the worst case also taken through the whole annual simulation?
And it also included the ocean net conditions, so that they were also in their worst state. So it was a really bad storm. Currents are running high, strong winds, with our worst case plume thrown into that. And as I said, in those circumstances, we wouldn't be operating. We've agreed we won't operate over 4 meters swell, and that's when that would happen. But they asked us what would happen if these conditions prevail. So that's what we did.
So I think to get the detail that you're after, because I can't recall off the top of my head, you'd have to look at McDonald and Hadfield's 2017, because they detail exactly what went into the worst case. And there was probably some minutes from the expert group, that helped to define what should go into that model. But I wasn't part of that, so I'm sorry, without looking at their report and then reporting back to you, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head just what that was. So, yeah, this is a nice segue then into the recovery, which I think is a really important point. So the time it will take for the Bentha community to recover is not able to be stated with precision at this time, as recovery rates can only be inferred from studies undertaken in much more sheltered locations or deeper areas. Seabed mining in this sort of environment has never been undertaken previously, so there are no good models to look at around the world for this. This sort of sandy shelf environment in such a dynamic area. There are some studies which we can look at and make and draw inferences from, but they're not exactly like this place. Some general points can be made though. Generally, communities associated with sand and high energy environments are frequently very frequently disturbed and continually in an early transitional stage, with recovery likely to be in the scale of months to a year. So it's about that sort of time period where recovery to the existing community would be expected. For most things, the sparse longer-lived species such as large starfish and gastropods could take several years to fully recover to numbers and sizes, but some could potentially migrate in from adjacent areas. And remember that it's just a quite a small area being sucked up and mined in any particular type, so there's opportunities then for organisms from the surrounding areas to actually move in. So now I'd just like to move on to the effects on fished species. So this is mainly fish, in fact, but one of the reports, which I'm the lead author on, does cover Kai minor species as well. I'll just forget what date that is. So if you look at McDonough 2015, the assessment of scale of marine ecological effects of seabed mining. So that would be a key one for looking at potential effects on Kai minor, as well as fished, commercially and recreationally fished species. So that review in this report on the spatial and foraging ecology of the key fauna occurring in the South Taranaki Bight identified that for most commercial, recreational and customary fish species, there should be negligible effect of the mining operations. And this is principally because the scale of the mined area and the areas of the elevated suspended sediments are small compared to the areas used by the populations of these species. Consequently, they are likely to be displaced from or experience a decrease in prey abundance or availability over a very small part of their distribution. We did identify in this report, however, that one species, eagle ray, may be affected by a moderate extent by the proposed iron sand recovery activities because their key core area of distribution in the South Taranaki Bight did overlap substantially with the mining area.
How would you describe a moderate extent? What does that really mean?
It means that some of their area will be affected. In this report, and I think also in the impact assessment, I'm not sure on what page, there's a useful table which shows the consequence levels for intensity of the activity, and it actually indicates the sort of aerial impact and what is meant by negligible and minor and moderate. So moderate means impacts more common, and about 5 to 20% of the habitat area is affected. So that's what moderate means. So there's a whole definition there, so that's a very useful table. So it's table 2.2, in McDiarmid 2015.
Where's that page from? Is that some sort of guidance?
Yeah, that's guidance that's used. It stems from a large number of Australian studies. It's after Fletcher. It comes from Fletcher. I can't give you the exact reference just here right now, but I can get that for you. So it's a large number of studies from which that is based.
It's in the impact assessment on page 119.
Is it? Okay, great.
Table 5.1.
Yeah, I'm more interested. I know that there's a lot of people who put the story in. What are the ANZAC? But it's just we have a foundation rather than the table.
I don't think I make reference to Fletcher here, but I can get hold of that document for you. Morgan, can you just note that?
Yep.
Great, thanks. The last point on this slide is I point out that acute and chronic impacts would only occur at significantly higher suspended sediment concentrations in excess of 500 milligrams per litre that are highly unlikely even at the point of sediment discharge. So this slide here looks briefly at fishing, and what is shown here is a diagram from a recent report, which I've got here. So this is McDiarmid 2024, which is the latest review of fishing in the South Taranaki Bight. And what is shown here is the number of fishing events aggregated into 0.2 degree squares for fishery management area 8. And that's the area which extends from Cook Strait up to North Taranaki Bight and further out to sea. It's shown here that are the fishing squares relevant to the South Taranaki Bight. You can see in yellow the proposed project area, and in orange, the very small area here, is the area of sediments in the water column up to 2 milligrams per litre, which various studies indicate is the lowest recorded suspended sediment concentrations that will be avoided by mobile fish. So we use that as a threshold to explore effects on fish. In green, and that shows the medium value. In red, it was shown the 99th percentile, meaning at some stage at any time. Sediment concentrations in that area will be 2 milligrams per litre or up to. In green and in blue are the same things shown for mining at area B at the outermost edge of the project area. So from this figure here, which is a summary of fishing over the years 2008 to 2023, you can see that fishing effort in the South Taranaki Bight occurs offshore in deeper water, reflecting the location of the midwater trawl fishery for jack mackerel. That's in these areas here, in particular, and along the coast near Foxton. Set netting in particular. Fishing effort in the proposed project area and Partia shoals generally is less intense. So as a guide here, this 15-year time period, for instance, this grey here is a total of between 200 and 300 fishing events in that square there over that time. So not a lot of events per week. Perhaps one a week and one fishing event a week. The thing to note from this report is that the overall number of fishing events for all methods combined in the proposed project area has declined over time, indicating likely minimal spatial displacement of commercial fishing due to the mining operations if it goes ahead. from time to time, suspended sediment concentrations above 2 mg/L will occur somewhere within the areas indicated in the figure, and the fish may move to an adjacent areas of lower sediment concentrations where they'll still be available to be caught.
When you say fish may move, is that...
So if they respond to the 2 mg...
Yes.
And then decide to move away from that high sediment zone, they'll move outside into an adjacent area where they could be fished. They'll still be alive, but they'll just avoid that sort of sediment concentration. So... overall, the project is unlikely to affect the abundance of fish species in the project area or beyond. So, just a brief summary of the effects on seabirds. So, newer studies indicate the South Taranaki Bight supports a relatively modest seabird assemblage occurring throughout the area and does not support large breeding colonies for any species. A NIWA review of the spatial and foraging ecology of 5 typical seabird species occurring in the South Taranaki Bight, and again that's also in this McDiarmid et al. 2015 report. One of the authors was a seabird specialist, Dr. David Thompson. A review of the spatial and foraging ecology of 5 typical seabird species occurring in the South Taranaki Bight identified that there should be negligible effects of mining 50 million tonnes per annum according to standard evaluation criteria, referring to that same table that I indicated earlier. This is because the scale of the mined area and the areas of the elevated suspended sediments are small compared to the area utilised by the populations of these species. Consequently, seabirds are likely to be displaced from or experience a decrease in prey abundance or availability of a very small part of their distribution. So certainly for those highly wide-ranging species like the petrels and the albatrosses and the mollymawks, they have very broad areas, and so the South Taranaki Bight is only one part of their broader distribution, and certainly the proposed project area is a tiny part of that. So moving on to effects on marine mammals of elevated suspended sediments. In general, the South Taranaki Bight has low inshore to moderate offshore suitability for cetaceans. That's whales and dolphins. So here's a diagram here showing cetacean richness with the very rich areas in red and the low, least rich areas in blue. You can see that inshore in the South Taranaki Bight, it's an area of low cetacean richness. The highest areas in New Zealand are found offshore around the Chatham Rise and various parts of the West Coast, but further offshore in deeper waters. You can get up to 10 species. However, the South Taranaki Bight is an important area for marine mammal conservation within New Zealand as a feeding and breeding location for different species at different times. So, for example, it's an important area for blue whales. But there is a low likelihood of marine mammals being present in the proposed project area. Effects on marine mammals of localised increases in suspended sediments from mining operations should be negligible, again, according to the criteria in that table that I indicated earlier. Again, this is because the scale of the mined areas and the areas of elevated sediments are small compared to the area used by the populations of these species. Consequently, they are likely to be displaced from or experience a decrease in prey abundance or availability over a very small part of their distribution. So impacts will be minimal. Oh, the other figure here shows the probability of occurrence of blue whales in the South Tamaki Bight. And you can see that there, areas of most likely to be found are in the deeper offshore areas of the South Tamaki Bight.
Blue whales, the marine mammal of most concern?
The pygmy blue whale, it looks like there's increasing evidence that it's a New Zealand resident, and the South Taranaki Bight is an important part of its distribution. It's not the only part, but you know, we do know from this modelling and other studies carried out that there's a large number of studies now looking at pygmy blue whales particularly. And when we say pygmy, we don't mean small.
Yeah, smaller.
It's just slightly smaller than the Antarctic blue whale by a few metres. It's still by far the, you know, a very large mammal.
Right.
Yep.
Thank you. And what is the evidence which leads you to that third bullet point conclusion? Is that because the environment doesn't support feeding? Well, I mean, where do you draw that conclusion from?
So these and other similar distribution models are taken from the DOCS cetacean sighting database. And then the environmental parameters associated with each of those sighting points is then used to model in between those points, basically, to fill in the gaps. And it's that sort of modelling which then can identify key areas around the New Zealand EEZ which are important or less important, more important or less important.
So the sighting data, is that just random reports?
That's random reports. Yeah, it's where folk have been out on the boat and they've seen a particular species. It's not as good as detailed survey data carried out by an expert, but it has its strengths. It should be viewed as complementary to other sorts of cetacean sightings data and survey data.
We did do our own aerial surveys out there over the years, several thousand hours, and our opponents, I think Alison, also did a number of Torres, was it? I think it's Sutton and Torres or somebody. They did their own whale surveys out there as well, and that data's all included in the summary graph I showed you earlier, the whale sightings.
Yeah.
All we've seen, and then since then, there's been a number of hydrophones sighted out there, listening, as one way to detect where the whales are around, because the sound travels a long way underwater. Alison can explain it better than I'm sure, but haven't in the mine area and nearby. There haven't been any recorded. They're going 24/7, those recorded.
Yeah, it just occurs to me that if this is an inhospitable area for recreation, you know, it's windy, a lot of wave action and so on, there are likely to be fewer people out there able to spot.
Absolutely. Yes, that's right. So the sighting density in the South Taranaki Bight is not as high as, say, in the Hauraki Gulf for exactly that sort of reason. There are fewer people, and the conditions for being out there to even sight anything is much lower.
Yes.
Yes, so these sorts of modelling exercise take that into account. They try and undo that sort of bias.
Right.
So there is specific ways of modelling that to take that into account.
Okay. And hydrophonic.
And also hydrophones on the seafloor are very good. That's right.
I think the depth of the ocean's important as well. These are large animals, and where they're mostly sighted, it's just on the edge of the continental shelf where it drops off and it is very deep. But Hauraki Trent comes in down the east coast of the North Island into the Kaikoura area. That's where they are, off Cape Farewell, going north on the edge of the continental shelf. Not in 20 to 30 metres of water.
So I guess in general, habitat models can be best seen as complementary to field surveys, as population surveys, even if repeated over seasons and years, can never monitor all locations at all times. So these sorts of models, they complement the surveys by using the associated environmental variables to fill in the gaps in space and time. So they're quite... They give good broad area overview, which you can never get by surveys.
Right, thank you.
Now, I probably need some help here, because something's happened to my screen. So.
It'll be my computer that's...
And it's not responding to...
Where did that come from?
I don't know.
I'll get rid of it, I think.
There we go.
If we need that back on, oh no, I think you might be wrong.
Okay, cool. Yep. Good, thank you. Okay, now turning to effects of underwater noise on marine mammals. So this is not my area of expertise, and so I'm really drawing upon the evidence of Dr. Simon Childerhouse. So you can ask me questions. I might be able to answer some of them, but if there are any detailed questions, we'll
probably... Well, this today is really an exercise of understanding the nature of the evidence, but also identifying where we find it. So if you can help us by pointing to that would be useful.
Yeah. Yep, so there's a more recent evidence or report by Dr. Childerhouse.
Yes.
From 2023.
And 24.
So that'll be on the list of the reports.
And didn't he do a final report this year?
Yeah.
He updated those reports.
Yeah. So, underwater noise very early on was identified as a potential risk for marine mammals from the proposed operations. So basically, when it comes down to it, a comparison of the estimated underwater noise data, and this is estimated to be emanating from the suction devices underwater, as well as the pumps from on board the vessels, that noise.
Main contributor is the pump in the seabed crawler.
Right. Okay.
It's electrically driven, but it gets quite high pitch, as you can understand.
So, comparing those data. That those estimated noise data with the thresholds, what is called the M-weighted thresholds for temporary threshold shift and permanent threshold shift effects in marine mammals. So this is impacts, temporary and permanent effects on the hearing, basically. Indicate there is no risk for either of these effects for any species at 500 metres or further from the operation, even if they were to spend 24 hours in the area at that distance.
Where do we find that?
Then you find that in those reports I've just indicated by Dr. Childerhouse.
Right. Thank you.
So he'll go, there's lots of detail there.
Right.
For noise impacts on marine mammals to have an actual effect at the individual or population level requires their marine mammals in the needed area around the operation. While this is clearly possible, the evidence suggests it's not very probable. The area has a very low likelihood in low abundance of marine animals being present. So there are some potential effects if they are close, but they're not likely to be in the area. The low level of marine mammal presence means that the likelihood of significant noise impacts on marine mammals is very low. And additionally, conditions halting operations if marine mammals are sighted within 500 metres further minimises this risk. So I think
that's one of the proposed conditions.
It is, that there'll be permanent observers on the mining vessel and serving up to 500 metres around the mining operations. And if marine mammals are sighted, then operations are drawn to a close immediately and then not started until they've moved off.
And does that mean ceasing operation and turning off the sources of noise?
Yes, we switch everything down at that point and we'd set the way for the mammals to go away. Our partners here on the southwest coast of Africa, they're seabed mining for diamonds, by the way, but that's just a different metallurgical process, very similar operation, but in a very similar vessel with the four anchors and the big chains. And I've had some trouble with whales there. The whales approach the vessel and love to scratch their backs on the anchor chains, so they just have to wait for the scratching their backs and off they go. But that's the only problem that I've had. And it's a very similar marine environment to the west coast of New Zealand that they are in. Ocean met conditions are very similar water depths. They're slightly deeper, they're 60 to 100 metres in water. They're a bit further out, that's all, but very similar conditions. And they have whales migrating down around that coast just the same as we have here.
And so would you do that for any marine mammal?
Sorry?
Or would you switch off operations for any marine mammal that's sighted? Or
yes, I think that's the case, but I'm not sure if we saw a penguin flying by, a fairy penguin or something. I think they do occur out there occasionally, or an orca that's going very, very fast way out there somewhere. Whether we need to shut down, I have to really look at the conditions.
Well, orcas, yes, because it's a marine mammal. Penguins, not necessarily. Yeah.
Okay.
One's a bird, one's a mammal.
Yeah. Okay. Well. It just shows that I'm a rock doctor and not a zoologist.
Sorry, Alan, that was a cheap joke.
No.
I think the other thing to point out is that there was a marine monitoring plan, and that will be the independent observers will be reporting through to the technical working group on a regular basis, and they'll be reviewing the sorts of operations that those that are reduced by those marine mammal sighting operations.
Yeah. And that's, I think, a part of that 28% shutdown period that we're not going to be operating. We've taken account of all of those sorts of issues. We hope.
Another question about that, Luke, that might be more for you. In the application document, the effects assessment, there are two separate sections relating to mammals. There is a marine mammal section, and then there is a noise effect section that focuses solely on mammals. Have you also combined, because effectively, you know, the combined effects, because the marine mammal section draws sort of overall conclusions on the effects on whales, and then you've got the noise effects, but there's no combined effects?
Yeah, so we can talk through that a bit further once I'm on the dais, but that's essentially the separation of the sediment concentrated effects and then the separation out of the noise effects. So they have both had a similar consequence sort of rating once you're considering the implementation of the consent conditions and the management options that controls that sit in behind those.
But there's no overall assessment on marine mammals, effects on marine mammals?
It's a cumulative assessment of noise and sedimentations.
Unusual to see those two effects separated for.
I guess that there's distinct drivers, different drivers for those effects.
But they could be affected by both sources of effects at the same time.
We concluded that the effects of the suspended sediment on whales and dolphins is negligible.
Yes.
I mean, impossible to actually measure. You know, it's going to be so tiny, if any. So I think one very small effect plus a very small effect is going to be still very small.
Small effect.
So. Okay, almost there. So I'll just talk briefly to the monitoring plan, but Luke will be available in a minute to speak more fully about these. So the pre-commencement environmental monitoring plan, some conditions 47 to 51. And it's on pages 265 to 273 in the main document. So that's the pre-commencement environmental monitoring plan. The PSEMP is going to be undertaken in accordance with the is a fundamental component of the project, with an overarching purpose being to build on the existing environmental information collated as part of the preparation for this application. It will be carried out for a minimum of 2 years of monitoring, and it will also serve to validate the planned operational sediment plume model. So I've heard about the plume model, which is used to predict the sorts of effects that could take place. So it's also planned to build an operation sediment plume, a little bit like forecasting the weather. So instead of forecasting how rainy it's going to be, it'll be forecasting based on where the mining is taking place, the characteristics of that sediment, the currents and wave activity on that day, any river inputs coming in from the coast, the background sediment concentrations, all that sort of thing, be all put into this model to predict where, you know, for hours to days ahead, where the plume might actually go. So if it can be predicted that the mining in this place means that the plume will impact on a particular vulnerable place like the traps, then mining can be changed or altered, stopped, in fact, until the conditions change and the plume model says it's okay, that area won't be affected anymore. So that's the whole point of having a predictive model like this, which is an operational model, like it's running 24/7 to give a real time or close to real time prediction of where the plume will actually be.
I understand that's
so this monitoring plan. Program is real well sorry is part of its use is to actually get the information necessary information to build that predictive model.
I understand the plan is to develop that model within 6 months, which is quite ambitious.
Is it
effectively an operational version of the existing model, or is that a model that will be developed from scratch?
It'll be built on the experience, mm-hmm. but it'll be built virtually from scratch using that experience that we've had building the existing model.
Can you just explain to me what that means? So you have this predictive model. What does that? How does that affect the ability to mitigate adverse effects?
It means that you'll have a heads up of hours to days ahead of time if there's going to be a substantive impact. On any,
so you could cease mining.
You see, you could cease mining before that impact happens.
And what are the key sort of inputs that create that?
It'll be the local. It'll be the weather at that time. So where the winds are coming from, and therefore where the currents are going to go, the wave conditions, and in particular, the sorts of particles which are in that part of the mining operation at the
silver content.
Yeah, the
so the feed, as I said, you're checking, testing before you
exactly.
Yes. And a great control drilling.
So it will be a real time. So it's the idea to literally test and plug it in the model and have a real time.
Yeah.
But it's not quite adaptive management. We had hard limits. And We've stayed away from that. We've got hard lines. And if we exceed those, we've simply got to stop and recommence or reassure the EPA that we're fine to go again.
So the model will, one of the output of the models will be the limits in the conditions.
Right. It'll be best when we finish in 20 years' time. That model. Of course, but we're doing our best efforts at the moment to start.
So hopefully the model will identify any problem before it happens and then help to actually avoid rather than mitigate.
But if it does happen, because I assume you'll review and continually improve, hopefully will not happen a second or a third time, or at least not a fifth time.
Coming out of the previous hearings, including one in Hauru, I don't think I explained our original mine plan. We have quite a detailed mine plan of these mining blocks and how we'll proceed with them, and we were going to start near shore at I think site A, as you call it, and head towards B. I think that what's come out of it is the least effects are at site B, where the water's deeper and the plume effects are minimal or less, a lot less. And so we think now we'll probably start out there and demonstrate what we're doing for 2 or 3 years. When everybody's happy with that, we may then come back in closer inshore and do some extraction and see what those effects are. I think that's a better way to do it than just start in close. And if things aren't going too well, everybody's going to be not very happy with it, and our model won't be as good as we'd like. So that is a plan. Perhaps we do have that flexibility to offer our mine plan. Because remember that from site A to site B is 14 kilometres. That's quite a long way across the ocean. And so it's not immaterial when we start out there and not here.
Okay, so this pre-commencement environmental monitoring over the two years before mining starts will also refine the methodologies and environmental management thresholds proposed in the post-mining commencement environmental monitoring and management plan, the EMMP. Okay, so the purpose of the PCEMP, just some bullet points there: establish the most up-to-date background pre-commencement environmental data that further identifies natural background levels, taking into account seasonal variations, also will provide the means by which any potential effects of the project can be quantified, better can confirm those, confirm the understanding of the seasonality and natural variability of the environmental parameters that will be monitored after mining starts, provide the data to validate the operational sediment plume model, provide data to verify the suspended sediment values are appropriate following the validation of the operational sediment plume model, confirm that the identified sampling locations are the best suited for the monitoring that will take place once mining starts, confirm that the parameters being monitored and the chosen methodology is the best suited for the ongoing monitoring work, and ensure compliance with the regulatory requirements. So it's an important piece of work to get done for a variety of reasons. So this diagram here shows a basic outline of the pre-commencement monitoring. So it's designed on a before-after gradient design. So with sampling locations at increasing distances from the mining area. And this design will be used for the water quality and sedimentation, primary productivity and monitoring, zooplankton monitoring, subtidal benthos monitoring, and intertidal reef aspects. The design approach has been selected as it allows mining TTR to continue to undertake environmental monitoring when the extraction is occurring, and facilitates a direct comparison between pre-commencement and operational periods. it's important to note that this overall pre-commencement monitoring is made up of a number of sort of subsets, some smaller monitoring programs, each focused on addressing a separate environmental parameter. And then the data analyses that will be used will be specific to each monitoring program and appropriate for that sort of animal or plant group or environmental parameter. For each of these, our monitoring, an annual and final monitoring report will also be prepared, and that will be provided to the technical review group. And we'll go on to then form the basis of the environmental monitoring and management plan. This is covered in conditions 54 to 56. So this is a continuation of the pre-commencement monitoring. It's the overarching document, this plan. It's the overarching document for the monitoring and management of the project-related effects and sets out the processes for the ongoing environmental monitoring once the extraction activities start. The final form, though, of the monitoring program will reflect the findings and recommendations from the final pre-commencement monitoring report, which of course will have been reviewed by the technical working group. The overall purpose of the environmental monitoring program is to ensure that any period-related effects are effectively and efficiently monitored and managed throughout the term of the project. And there's a list there stating the reasons for that, ensuring compliance, stating clear objectives, implementation of an environmental monitoring programs, how they're going to be done, verifying the environmental performance through the monitoring project. It'll detail the data analyses and processing for all the parameters. It'll provide details of reporting methods and frequency for the parameters being monitored. It'll identify all the operational responses to be undertaken if suspended sediment limits or water quality limits are reached. So again, it'll be a key document. So this diagram here just briefly shows how all these components will work in concert and interact. So the environmental management strategy, which is part of the EWMP, is essential for the successful implementation of the project through ensuring compliance and highlighting key environmental objectives and reporting requirements. If any anomalies or unexpected results are found as part of the environmental monitoring programs, then the environmental management strategy identifies a framework for addressing any such event. Its objective is to undertake a science-based, systematic approach to monitoring and managing the effects of the project in the South Taranaki part.
Sorry, Alison, causation plays a very big role in that strategy,
yeah.
As you described, and we all understand it's a very dynamic environment.
Yeah.
So what do you think the likelihood is that causation could be established if something unexpected happens and is... What
yeah.
confidence would that approach provide then? That
well, we'll depend on the level of detail that the pre-commencement and then post mining monitoring actually establishes. We expect that there will be quite a high variance in variability in the makeup of the sand communities as storm events come through. We've got, I think, the operational sediment plume modelling will give reasonable expectation of identifying if a sediment event will have occurred at a particular place, But also there's monitoring, fixed monitoring stations of water quality, which will be taking place. So causation is always very difficult to pin down. But sedimentation effects, for example, we know what happens in high sediment events in terms of non-fatal effects on fish, for example, you know, abrasion of gills and that sort of thing. But that's at very extreme values, which the mining isn't expected to produce. It's a long-winded way of saying it. Causation is difficult to pin down, but the monitoring programs should assist as much as possible.
And will the modelling that would be used consider also the cumulative effects? So if there was a perfect storm, a literal storm, and
certainly by adopting this gradient design, this sort of gradient design, I mean, that's why you would want to use that sort of design rather than impacted, non-impacted place, because it's expected that any impact that's from the mining would be show a gradient effect close to the mining site as opposed to further away. And this sort of gradient where you've got monitoring stations at various distances should show up whether there's an effect due to mining or not. If it's too small to be measured with that sort of design, then it's probably small.
I haven't looked. There is a draft of the EMP in the application documents, is that right? Does it include the EMPs?
Yes, that's where that document's come from. I can go back and check if that exact flow chart is in there. But
It is.
The document itself.
It is. So I can't tell exactly what.
That's right.
It's in around about just after page 277, so page 279, I think. Something like that. So I think this is my last slide. And I'll just briefly point it out. So the final environmental monitoring program will incorporate environmental performance thresholds into the monitoring of suspended sediment concentrations in the South Taranaki Bight. Now, these thresholds are expressed as the 25th, so you've heard us talk about the median or the 50th percentile and the 99th percentile. So these thresholds are expressed as the 25th, the 50th, which is the median, the 80th, and the 95th percentile suspended sediment limits, with the 95th percentile being a fixed limit, that's condition 5A, and the 25th, 50th, and 80th percentiles, conditions 5C, which allows variation of up to 10% as determined over any 12-month period. That's the proposed condition. If these limits are exceeded, as determined by monitoring and the operational sediment plume model, then extraction activities must cease until TTR can demonstrate compliance with those limits again to the satisfaction of the EPA. And I guess that'll go through the technical working group, would it, first, and then on to the EPA? I'm not sure about that.
Possibly a dumb question, but what does TRG mean when it comes to these
technical review group?
So just a point about why there are no values. Actually, perhaps Luke can better explain those when he gets to this point. It's just some of those values were put in place very late, and three of the sites, Crack 1, Crack 2, and the Project Reef, which are down the bottom here, were introduced after that initial modelling had taken place. So an important part of the pre-commencement mining is to actually
develop
those values.
So we don't have them yet at all.
We don't have them yet at all. Yeah.
Yeah. So all those three bottom sites, crack one, crack two, and Project Reef, and then the 25th, 50th. So anyone that has a TRG reference was a result of an input by the DMC for in their decision in the 2017 process. Yeah. So at that point in time, we didn't have the measurements that aligned with those different percentiles on those three new sites, because they were presented as part of that hearing process by some of the submitters on the application. So what these conditions do, and I'll talk through that in a little detail once I shift positions with Alison, it provides for a process through which those limits are determined. So without getting too far ahead of myself, the limits are directed to an understood sort of level of effect. So the percentiles are not up for change, but the numbers which sit against those percentiles are the figures that need to be determined through the use of the pre-commencement environmental monitoring and also the operational settlement plume model. And so they will spit out the validated, verified number that sits underneath those, which are the hard limits determined through the percentiles for each of those different elements.
And sorry, the DMC that established these three additional sites and the additional percentiles, what decision was that?
2017. So
we have in 2017 and 2024.
Yes. So the 2024 process didn't go through to a decision. Just to provide further direction, it's summarised in section 6.4.6 of the impact assessment, and then sort of the response process is talked about in section 6.5.3.
So that's my last slide.
Excellent. Nicely timed.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm.
So we'll take a break for 15 minutes. We want to hear everything you've got to say so that we're not constrained by time, but can you give us an indication as to how long the rest of the presentation may take?
There are probably some intricacies in the conditions that might be helpful to be understood, and I imagine that they may garner some questions around that process. I probably wouldn't expect, subject to the number of questions, 45 minutes, an hour maximum, and then I'm not sure Mr. Slyfield as well.
I'm aiming to be relatively brief.
Okay.
20 minutes probably.
Okay, that sounds all fine. Thank you. And then there may be a couple of other issues. One of the things that we want to hear from you about, Mr. Eggers, is a bit more on the proposed site visit. So we'll leave that to the end. All right, thank you. We'll just knock off for 15 minutes. Thank you.